This is Andrew Heaton, and you're listening to the Reason Podcast. You can subscribe to us on iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. I'm joined today by Nick Gillespie.
Hi, Andrew.
Catherine Mangu Ward.
Howdy.
And Matt Welch.
Good morning.
And our Secretary of Education, Betsy DeVos, is either taking a measured approach to sexual assault victims and accused assailants, or alternately, she's letting education backslide into rape culture. Last Thursday, she met with three different groups, advocacy groups and survivors of sexual assault, men's rights groups and students falsely accused of sexual assault, and university administrators and Title IX coordinators. So, Nick, first of all, what is Title IX and is she chipping away at it?
Well, no, I don't think so. Title IX is a federal law that was passed in the early 70s, which mandates that any K through 12 or higher education institution that receives federal funds offers equal opportunities for men and for women for education. And in general, it was something that ratified where the country was going, and it makes sense. The federal government should not be discriminating against people on the basis of gender or sex or on the basis of anything. And it was true that, when it was passed, there was, a lot of opportunities that were afforded men or boys and men that were not to women. Over time, it became the hot button issue for a long time on Title IX actually had to do with college level sports in the 90s and early 2000s. There were a spate of stories about how Title IX language was being interpreted to mean that there needed to be the same number of scholarship athletes at Division I schools for boys teams and girls teams. It led to a bunch of men's teams being cut in order to equalize the numbers. More recently, and this is something that when Matt was editing the magazine, he put out a fantastic story from Kathy Young about how the Office of Civil Rights within the Department of Education sent out in 2011 what's called a Dear Colleague letter, where they gave guidelines suggesting that when you were dealing with questions of violence on campus, particularly sexual assault, that the standard of the burden of proof should be a preponderance of the evidence rather than a higher standard when you're going after or when colleges were investigating charges of sexual assault. At the same time, it also suggested heavily that that schools need to have an affirmative response to every case of this type of thing. And it's led to a kind of proliferation of cases and of as important, actually, processes that are quasi-legal where students on campus, somebody brings a charge against a student, and then there are kind of kangaroo courts oftentimes where the accused person, the defendant, is not given any kind of preparation, any kind of counsel on how to act and things like that. And that's basically what we're talking about here. And I don't think it's a rollback of civil rights, especially if you believe that I think, as I think most people do, that sexual assault and rape are serious crimes and that they should be being investigated by police and by a legal system that's actually trained to deal with this, as opposed to kind of mock trials that are typically staffed by administrators or faculty or even students who have no real understanding of legal process and of due process with a very low level of guilt being established. It's led to a bunch of problems, including, any number of lawsuits against schools by people who have been kicked out under Title IX proceedings or Office of Civil Rights proceedings, who were like, my rights were violated here. And I think, that's really something that we need to look at. And I think DeVos is in the right direction on this one.
Matt, do you think that the concept of innocent until proven guilty is a standard which should be involved at any level of rulings, whether it's in a court of public opinion, whether it's at a university administrator level, or whether in the courts where that's typically the standard that we're using?
The court of public opinion is a different place, which I think it's still we should err on the side of that as an instinct. But I think it's okay to believe or assert, even if it's not true, That OJ murdered his wife. You know, even though he's never been found by a jury to have done so. I think we can hold those things separately. And there's different levels of standards for how you declare someone's guilt. You know, whether it's a civil or criminal, whether it's a preponderance of an evidence, and these types of things. But generally speaking, yeah, of course, you're innocent until proven guilty, and you should go through something like a due process. And all you have to do is Google the name Laura Kipnis, although it's difficult to spell, to see the kind of just insane things that have resulted from that 2011 guidance and the way that Title IX is being used, not just to adjudicate the sexual assault things, but just actually to step on the toes of normal discourse on college campuses. So there's nothing wrong at all with acknowledging that and actually taking some proactive steps to, you know, roll the calendar back to 2010, which is kind of a segue into something here. Betsy DeVos is this hate figure on the left, and it's very interesting to watch. I've always wondered, and Nick and I wondered about this in our book, about how the Democratic Party went from being the party where the president, Jimmy Carter at the time, was kind of at the forefront of deregulation to hating it as much as humanly possible and associating it exclusively with evil people like Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher. I think we're kind of watching that happen in semi-real time with education policy and Betsy DeVos. How does this process work? Arnie Duncan, or however you pronounce his first name, Obama's former Chicago schools chief and secretary of education here under Obama, he came from the school reform tradition, the charter schools and school choice tradition. And they injected some limited amounts of this in the Race to the Top initiative. And it's as if Democrats are just rising up and striking that from the collective public memory as just like an aberration that we shall never speak of again, and asserting that Betsy DeVos is the lone hate figure that is trying to rip up all of a public education and replace it with the Koch brothers oligarchy or something like that. And this is applied to everything from Title IX stuff to charter schools and whatnot. One random data point on this, there's a piece, a pretty good one in Slate a couple of days ago, that kind of took the piss out of Nebraska Senator Ben Sasse in a sympathetic way, saying that he's a performative anti-Trumper who expresses anguish at the behaviors of the president, but when push comes to shove, he doesn't stand in his way in any meaningful way. I don't necessarily agree with it, but it's a pretty good piece. But one of the first items of things that Ben Sasse should have done is obviously stand in the way of Betsy DeVos doing these terrible things. And it's like, you know, this is exactly what Republicans have been talking about in education policy for like 30 years. There's nothing at all new about this. And a lot of it overlaps with where Democrats, especially on the local level, but also the previous president and his secretary of education have been. So there's something about her character and her ability to be a kind of a lightning rod for protest here, which suffuses everything she does, whether it's good or bad.
I was amazed at the backlash from the left when Betsy DeVos had her hearings to come into the administration. I understood and agreed with the rancor surrounding Jeff Sessions. With Betsy DeVos, yeah, I thought that she was unqualified but not crazy. But my many friends from the progressive side of things were apoplectic that she was getting brought in. To back up a little bit, I want to talk a bit more about the rape culture that she is either tackling or dealing with. Catherine, do you think that we have pervasive rape culture? Is it something that is getting better? Is it something that is expanding in terms of definition? What's going on, and how concerned should policymakers be about it?
I mean, I don't think that phrase is particularly meaningful. It's designed to encompass almost everything from actual violent rape to a sentence that a professor said in class. For instance, this last week, Reason had a piece up about a law prof who used a hypothetical example involving Brazilian waxing on an exam question and wound up being disciplined for sexual harassment. Almost certainly at some point in those proceedings, the phrase rape culture was uttered. So I think I kind of want to leave that phrase aside. I do think that DeVos's move away from non-binding administrative guidance is an excellent, excellent development. It's not good rulemaking. It's not good policy for the powerful people in a relationship to just send letters to every college in America saying, we're not saying you have to do this, but we're kind of saying you have to do this about issues as important as this. And that includes the transgender bathroom rules, which Trump already rolled back that guidance. And now the Title IX Dear Colleague letter, you know, the idea that DeVos is saying, you know, at my direction, the department will no longer mask new regulations as Dear Colleague letters and will issue new regulations only after appropriate notice and public comment, and that people would flip their shit about that shows how unmoored people have gotten in the face of Betsy DeVos. And I think in some ways what should be more controversial are her decisions earlier this month to do a regulatory reset with some of the rules around student loans and both the gainful employment rules, which Obama put into place, saying essentially if your graduates don't earn enough money, maybe you're not eligible for federal funds in certain very narrow programs for for-profit schools, and also some rules that allow students who have been defrauded or who claim they've been defrauded to get forgiveness on their loans. That's actually a place where I think there are more legitimate questions about motivations and where that decision is coming from. I still think her decisions are the right ones, but it seems so clear to me to not make policy through Dear Colleague letters is a move in the right direction.
With education policy at a federal level, that to me is something that kind of within a Goldwater rubric of if it can be handled by the states, it should be. That strikes me as a very clear one. But there's this huge firestorm over whoever is the Secretary of Education and what they're doing. What is the actual role for the federal government in the education system, Nick?
Well, I mean, the federal government, you know, at least since the 60s, has expanded the amount of money that it gives to states at, you know, all levels of education. You know, whether it's through student loans and Pell Grants for college and graduate school, or through various other programs for K-12 schools. And, you know, yeah, I go back and forth between, you know, how much local, you know, I care less about the funding source, to be quite honest, about schools, and more about the decision, like how do people get to choose where they go to school? And I think schools would be cheaper. Certainly colleges would be cheaper if there was less free money or subsidized money given to people to go to schools. Because once you start injecting a lot of third party money into schools with relatively little oversight, you know, prices inflate. Education is one of those things, you know, certainly colleges, where the costs have been going up much faster than the regular rate of inflation. And part of the reason for that is there's so much money that is available that people either get as grants or can borrow against, that, you know, the schools that are charging tuition and fees just kind of increase their costs in order to absorb all of that money that's out there. And there's a good case to be made. You know, there's something like 4,000 four-year universities and colleges in the country. That's probably an oversupply if you were thinking about it more in terms of you know, are these schools really getting customers or, you know, students who would pay, you know, something closer to full freight if they knew. But ultimately, to go to your question, like I'm less concerned about whether, you know, it's the local government, the state government, or the federal government that is dictating or that is kind of doing the funding. I'm more concerned, particularly at the K-12 level, about whether or not individual people, the parents and students, have a choice among schools, because it seems to me that the kind of traditional monopoly that is granted by a conventional public school system, where your zip code and your parents' ability to buy a house or to rent a house in a particular neighborhood really dictates what your choices are. To me, that's a bigger issue than whether or not it's the state a local city or the federal government that's dictating things. One of the problems with, you know, anything being dictated by the federal government, there should be oversight involved. And it's true that there are a lot of colleges, for instance, both public and private or nonprofit and for-profit, where they have terrible rates of, terrible rates of people finishing, of people getting jobs in the areas that they were done. And it's you know, it's probably a good oversight. It's certainly a good oversight by the federal government to say, look, if this school is doing nothing other than collecting people's student loans, they should be kicked off the program. I'm not sure that that gives you a clear, decisive answer for anything. But, I think people need to recognize that the more money that gets put into the system, the people putting the money in or the governments putting the money in are going to extract certain kinds of promises. Sometimes that's good. A lot of times it's bad.
So we have all these student debts that are, you know, gigantic sources of frustration for younger people and students that recently graduated. I think that's something that Bernie Sanders tapped into during his campaign, although it always kind of didn't confuse me. It was just interesting to me that the narrative of, you know, all ills are caused by evil rich people. And I wasn't sure how college loans factored into that. But nonetheless, they're there and they're large and looming. Is there anything you would do to try and rectify what we have right now in the outstanding debt, Catherine?
I have long believed that the college loan system would be much better if it were administered by banks. And it used to be, sort of. There was, the subsidies have are longstanding. And there are also, of course, the Pell Grants, which are different than loans. But so the distortions have always been there in the market. But it was only fairly recently that we moved to a system where the federal government is the actual possessor of those loans, the entity that does the lending. And, you know, the thing about banks is, admittedly, as the housing crisis showed, they are imperfect when it comes to estimating who's most likely to pay back what when. But they're a heck of a lot better at it than the federal government. And it's always just been very unclear to me why we don't say, hey, let's let banks decide who's a good loan risk. Let's say, hey, if you want to get a graduate degree in chemical engineering, you know, it's going to be pretty easy for you to get that money. And if you want to get a undergraduate from a low-ranked college in art history, yeah, probably no one wants to lend you that money. And the notion that somehow we have an entitlement to get an undergraduate degree from a low-ranked college in art history is much bandied about by the – bandied is not a word – much bandied about by conservatives who complain about this sort of thing. But they're right. It is dumb to subsidize that person's education. And, you know, I think the solution lies there. And it's not surprising to hear me or probably anyone on this podcast say it. But prices have information. Interest rates, as set by banks, have information in them. And we've right now totally eliminated that information from the system. So the result is that we have $1 trillion in debt out there floating around radicalizing young voters.
One thing that I think gets lost in most of these conversations is that as bad as some of the kind of spillover effects of various bad higher education policies have evidently been to the naked eye, if we were to go to a system that Bernie Sanders wants, which is essentially more of a German system, you get college for free. Why don't you look at the numbers of, I don't know, Germans who get college educations compared to the number of Americans. We have a trade surplus in college students here, people wanting to come in and take our college because we have, in this imperfect way, but in a way in which there are, at least compared to the K-12 system, a lot of market signals, a lot of choice. You can go to a community college, you can go to the DeVry Institute, you can go to whatever Harvard, Yale, Hell Bath Catherine went to. All of these are different possibilities here in a way that doesn't exist in countries that have a top-down education system. So I think we should sometimes proceed from, well, what are the differentiating things that have allowed at least the creation of what in many senses is the world's most envious higher education system to exist here. And I don't think it is excessive interest and centralization on the federal government level that allowed that to happen. I think there's actually a lot more speciation that has been helpful in that process. So I would go more in that direction. And I just think, into Nick's discussion on the role of the federal government here, at some point we just we're nationalizing too much. And this even gets back to the Betsy DeVos thing, you know, that is the thing that's going to get people excited in the morning about how evil the Trump administration is not only just disproportionate, but it's kind of weird. I mean, we got so many education disputes where I live here, education policy disputes in Brooklyn, some of which Jim Epstein did a wonderful documentary about last year, that you would think that people would kind of look to where they live, and they do in their behavior, but not nearly enough. I think we're federalizing too much, which then puts policy at the whims, not just of, hysterics like Bernie Sanders, but also that means the zero sum game of politics is going to then all the awful pendulums that come with that are going to be inflicted on education policy. And it doesn't have to be like that. We have better systems that are actually happening in front of us. Let's figure out what makes that work and have more of it.
To pivot somewhat internationally, Donald Trump Jr. took a meeting with a Kremlin-connected Russian lawyer during the 2016 campaign, ostensibly to collect damaging information about Hillary Clinton. And he even responded in the email, which is the most astonishing thing to me, because you never respond to potentially illegal, incriminating, or even just nasty activity in email form. You call them and then hang up on them. But he said, if it's what you say, I love it, especially later this summer. Nick, was he colluding with the Russians? Is he a colluder?
No, I don't think so. I struggle to understand. You know, this is unseemly stuff, but I don't. You know, when you say Kremlin connected lawyer and it's Russians and it's this and it's that, it's like, you know, I would like to see all of those things knitted together a little bit more, because it's not clear that the lawyer, you know, the lawyer was not an agent of the Russian government. I don't know that it's wrong. And, you know, there may be legal rules against this or customary rules against this. But if somebody, you know, if you're in a presidential campaign and somebody says, hey, I've got something interesting that might help you, I don't understand, like, exactly who's going to say, no, I'm not going to, you know, I'm just going to ignore that or not. And it turns out it's not clear that there was any actionable information there or anything like that. So to me, and this goes along with the Betsy DeVos stuff. And I say this, you know, I'm not a fan of Trump's. I think he's you know, certain things that are happening under his administration are okay. But this is, you know, a kind of derangement syndrome. I mean, Trump has deranged the press and many people in America even more than Obama did, and even more than Bush did, and even more than Clinton did in the 90s, when people were, you know, like Jerry Falwell, were putting out videos talking about all of the bodies at the MENA airstrip in Arkansas. And it seems to me, you know, it's not clear to me what this means exactly. And again, one of the other issues is that, you know, this is all part of a, you know, there are all sorts of like Uber or narratives going on here, and overarching narratives. And, you know, this is all partly in the service of obviously destabilizing Trump and delegitimating him. But it's also, this is why Hillary lost. And I feel bad for the Democratic Party and partisans who are still trying to figure out why Hillary lost and are looking for the answer in the Kremlin, because it seems to me that there's a much clearer understanding of why she lost the election, and it has everything to do with the campaign she ran and the way Democrats talked about certain issues and refused to talk to certain people in America. None of that is a brief in favor of Trump, but this kind of stuff, it's, I find it puzzling, and, I don't see this being the thing that ends, you know, anybody's reign of terror in Washington.
To push back a little bit, Nick, the most of the pundits that I'm reading and listening to, even on the right, indicate that this is not treasonous behavior from Donald Trump Jr., but it's certainly unseemly. It's certainly something that goes beyond the pale of normal American politics. Do you think that you know, potentially getting information from the Russians does not qualify as such?
You know, what did Yeah, well, wait, when we say the Russians, you know, what do we mean? I mean, because if it's, you know, and it's also clear, you know, Bibi Netanyahu had certain favorites in the, you know, in various American elections. Hillary Clinton, the reason why Putin supposedly has such a hard-on against her is because she openly campaigned against him in his election in Russia the second time around. This is what happens. And I mean, the idea of being shocked at the idea that foreign countries have favorites or people within those countries have favorites. This, to me, it doesn't rise to the level of disestablishing the sanctity of American elections. I mean, I like these conversations come out, and all of that kind of stuff. But it's just no, I don't think it's treasonous. And to the extent it looks bad, part of it is yet to be seen because we don't know exactly what transpired, other than it seems as if no real intelligence or nothing useful came out of that particular conversation. But then are we going to say, you know, assuming we were told that it was 17, federal intelligence agencies that all said that the DNC emails that were hacked, that was a Russian plot, a Russian government plot. It turns out, no, it was four of them that actually said that, and they said it with varying degrees of certitude and all of that kind of stuff. But even there, and again, that's troubling, but it's, for all sorts of reasons. But the real question is what's in the material also? Because that's one of the reasons why Hillary Clinton did poorly or did not win was because the hacked DNC emails that came out, showed that the DNC had the fix in against Bernie Sanders. And it was liberals who were pissed off about that. It was, people in the Democratic Party, and they should have been right to the Democratic National Committee or the Republican National Committee is not supposed to play favorites. They're supposed to stage a primary process that allows people to rise or fall based on the merits of their arguments and their policies. And there was clear evidence that the DNC under Debbie Wasserman Schultz was doing everything it could to kneecap Bernie Sanders once it became clear that he was a legitimate voice within the Democratic Party. So, with any time we're dealing with hacked documents or leaked documents, the same thing happened with people like Chelsea Manning or Edward Snowden. You immediately try and discredit the source to take people's attention away from what's actually in the files or what's in the material that's being leaked. And I think we always need to balance that. Plus, we're in a bizarre world of like super anti-Russian animus, which I think clouds a lot of people's judgment.
It's also if you're even moderately successful in Russia, you're probably quote unquote Kremlin connected because it is a kleptocracy that has its fingers in everything. So there's a certain implication that this was personally directed by Vladimir Putin, which is not immediately clear. Nonetheless, I'll posit, Matt, is it possible that Gary Johnson would have done far better but turned down any type of awful material that the Russians had out of honor and respect for American democracy?
you'll have to get him off the bike long enough to assess that. I would have a hard time imagining that Gary Johnson would do that. But I disagree with Nick on this. I think that the action was wrong on its face. Not just the responding to an email set up saying the Russian government is anxious to help you in your campaign. Responding to that with an "I love it." And scrambling the jets as quickly as possible to arrange a meeting with top campaign staff in Trump Tower within a matter of hours, really. And then
that timeline is compressed. It wasn't he didn't drop everything. He was traveling, and it took weeks. But I mean, what should he have done then? Should he have just like not responded? Should he have said no? Should he have turned things over to the FBI?
I at a time when Russia is, this is not something that's either conspiratorial or obscure. At a time when Russia is doing what it can to get its fingers in the electoral process in the West, you turn it over to the FBI. When someone comes, it's like what Al Gore did with a briefing book, or the Gore campaign did in 2000. When there is a country that is a competitor, an adversary, not an enemy. But someone who is out there, not necessarily looking out for the U.S. best interest, and they had a flashing red light saying the Russian government is here to help you in this moment. You turn that the hell over to somebody else. You don't enthusiastically take that meeting, and then you don't lie about it, which they have done, kind of systematically changing their story about this meeting and its implication and these types of things. And I understand that they're under pressure, but at some point, when you have a half a dozen different administration officials who have to retroactively change their story about various moments of time in which they met with Russians in 2016, we can remove the benefit of the doubt, even if there's no collusion. And I don't know. And I don't know, and I don't care on some level in this micro moment whether this bit of evidence knits the whole story together. I'm not looking for a narrative to be knit together. I'm actually more interested in making it a smaller case. The smaller case is, don't take the meeting, don't say I love it, and don't lie to people about it. It's pretty simple, and I think that there's a reason why you have quite a number of commentators who are not, I would say, part of the conspiratorial, democratic, wound-licking left, who are looking at this and saying, yeah, let's just call this bad behavior because it is.
I think what Matt has described is very clearly the right thing to do and the thing that should have happened. But I also think that it's pretty tough to see the bright line here in a way that people who are currently really invested in losing their shit over that email exchange are kind of alighting over. Eugene Volokh has written some really good stuff at The Washington Post about this, where he basically says, like, listen, on the question of the legality of this from the perspective of campaign law, it's really very hard to draw a line between when a campaign is allowed to communicate in any form with any person who is not a full U.S. citizen with no ties to a foreign government of any kind without, you know, walking across this line of receiving material support, and there's like a bunch of terms of art get in there where there's a sort of question of like, well, would this be sellable information? Like, for instance, poll results, would this be actionable information, you know, in terms of blackmail or something like that? But, we don't want to actually foreclose the ability of people who are running for office to communicate with people who are not American citizens. And it strikes me from the perspective of, well, you know, was this illegal, which is a separate question than what Matt is answering there. I think Matt is quite right that this was like just A, dumb, and B, kind of sinister. But on the question of legality, I'm actually quite sympathetic to the Trump argument of, hey, listen, we were just talking to someone who offered to help. And that it can't be true that every time a foreign citizen says to somebody who's running for office, hey, I have something you might be interested in, that you've committed a crime.
Just in a larger sense, too, again, you know, this is, you know, what we are witnessing. And again, I say this as somebody who has no case for Trump. What we're witnessing is a very systematic attempt to undermine every aspect of the legitimacy of the Trump presidency. You know, and Trump doesn't help his own case when he does stuff like obviously lies about, you know, the historicity of his electoral college win or the size of his inaugural the crowd at his inauguration. But, you know, in the 90s, we saw a similar game play out against the Chinese because they were the rising threat before 9/11. You know, then there was 9/11. Now it's back to Russia as the bugaboo. But, everybody, Republicans and conservatives, were overheating about all sorts of collusion between Bill Clinton and Chinese donors who had ties to the Chinese government, et cetera. You know, we need to take a deep breath. We should be very interested and aware of attempts by foreign governments to influence elections. We should also own the fact that our government does that all the time, both in explicit and kind of occult ways. And it just seems to me that, if the idea is that Vladimir Putin is supremely evil, and so anything that's coming out of Russia is, you know, just verboten, I think that's kind of a stupid, set of foreign policies to have, and it's not going to, you know, get us very far. We know that the Trump administration in many ways is like blazingly incompetent. They have still not, you know, even nominated people to take over many positions that they need to appoint and things like that. Eric Trump, Donald Trump Jr., Ivanka Trump, you know, like none of these people are going to, you know, they're not going to be a next generation of founding fathers or anything like that. But this type of story strikes me as a distraction from what policies do we need to be implementing, both whether it's foreign policy or domestic policy, whether it's trade policy and immigration policy and things like that. It just seems to me to be a lot of this is good for cable news. It's not particularly good for anything related to, you know, whether or not the country is going to be better off in the next 3 or 4 years.
Catherine, I don't know that the Putin and the Kremlin specifically wanted Trump to win that much more than Hillary Clinton. I guess they did, but I could see them just trying to kind of delegitimize American institutions, in which case they've done a pretty good job, I think.
I'm sorry to interrupt, Andrew. America did a fucking great job of delegitimating its institutions. The media doesn't have like a 30-year low ranking of confidence among Americans because of anything the Russians did, nor does Congress, nor does the office of the presidency. We had under George Bush, we had a president who lied about all sorts of things. You know, he was either stupid and he was misdirected about weapons of mass destruction, or he lied about them. He lied about surveillance programs. He had all kinds of secret legal documents to allow for torture, even when, you know, the American governmental system, you know, said that it was not proper. Barack Obama was a huge liar, both when it came to things like Obamacare and like basic claims about keeping your doctor and all of that shit. He was even cagey about an individual mandate during the passage of the bill. And then he totally lied about surveillance programs that he expanded, and he was secretive. You know, he was putting journalists in jail. So it's like, don't blame the hollowing out of confidence and trust in American institutions on Vladimir Putin. That is blame shifting. That is really part of the problem. And it's one of the reasons why people continue, you know, why Trump has bad ratings, why Congress has bad ratings, and why the media has bad ratings, because they're always looking for somebody else to blame.
But in fairness, Nick, Andrew was just asking a question, looking at, you know, who Putin was rooting for.
Well, what I was going to get at, and I think you make a good point, Nick, that we've done a terrific job of ruining our own institutions without any foreign help whatsoever.
Yeah, I mean, is Putin to blame for declines in trust in law enforcement in America because law enforcement discriminate, or, you know, because they've created a system of fines that, you know, kind of create a peonage in counties so that you get a speeding ticket and then you get another ticket and then you get another ticket? I mean, you know.
But who's making that argument? No one's making that argument.
No. The reason why trust and confidence in major American institutions, including business, including politics, including the nonprofit sector, it's solely because of American actions. It's not about the Chinese.
That's not true, though, right? It is also because globally, Putin has made it very clear that he is explicitly trying to push the policies and politics of other nations in a direction that is friendly to him. He has been open about interfering in France's politics by supporting Le Pen's National Front. In Hungary, he's supported Golden Dawn in Greece, which is basically neo-Nazis. I mean,
so
this is not—
does that delegitimate
it is not
the
as
United
if America
States?
Exists in a vacuum.
Oh, yeah, I agree with
yeah,
that.
I'm
just saying, though—
it's not as if America exists in a vacuum where we're just, like, sucking all by ourselves. It is also true that other entities are trying to make us suck more in a very specific way, and people are worried
yeah,
about that.
Yeah, but you know what? I'll flip back over to the Nick column here. Like, it has been very irritating to watch the all kinds of different reactions to the election. If we're not strong enough to withstand some penny ante like sitting on a bunch of oil piece of crap in
Russia.
Well,
but I think we are. I think the answer here is still that the Russian influence in U.S. elections was marginal and basically irrelevant. We are strong enough to withstand it. We are making mistakes all on our own. Nick is right about that. But it doesn't mean Putin's not trying to mess with U.S. elections and that we shouldn't freak about that.
We should freak. I agree. We should figure out exactly what's going on. But we also shouldn't then also, you know, be on a kind of moral high ground as if the United States doesn't do that all the time. That's what world powers do. And it can be good or bad, and it can be more or less open. You know, but like the reason why, you know, people hate Washington, it's not because Vladimir Putin planted a bunch of stories on Sputnik. It's because of Paul Ryan. It's because of Nancy Pelosi. It's because of Harry Reid. It's because of Mitch McConnell and a bunch of spineless politicians who never talk about principle and who just fucking lie all the time or switch positions as if, I always was in favor of the nuclear option, for confirming nominees. No, I was always against it. I mean, that's where like 99% of the problems in America today and American governance, I think, are.
I think I speak for everyone in saying that our government has been perfect in its execution for the last 20, 30 years, that all of our hallowed institutions are living up to everything they should be, and that all of our policies are great, particularly healthcare, which should be banged out and fixed in the next 3 or 4 days, I would think.
We're done with that, right? Fixed it.
There's been one or two minor setbacks, one of which is that Senator John McCain is recovering from surgery in Arizona, which means that Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has one less vote to get his health care bill through in the Senate, and he needs them. Because as of now, both Rand Paul and Senator Collins from Maine are not planning to vote for it, which means that he needs every other Republican that he can get. Nick, is this better or worse than the House bill?
I don't think I don't think it makes any difference. The Republicans do not have an actual repeal and replace bill in place. And the two of them, you take two bad bills and reconcile them, it's not going to do anything. At this point, I think a better course of action would be to kind of admit defeat and either come up with an actual bill that, fits for some of the more libertarian-leaning people in the House. I'm speaking as a libertarian here, both in the House and in the Senate, and would actually do things like not just get rid of Obamacare individual mandate, but then get rid of fines or taxes or penalties that do the same thing, but you're claiming it's something different because a Republican put it together. We need to have a conversation about how we repeal and replace Obamacare with a system that is more market friendly and effective that way. So I don't mean to be this dismissive, but it's just, it's like you're not even rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic if you're talking about whether the Senate bill or the House bill is better. They're both in steerage and the water's already over their heads.
Something that baffles me, Catherine, is that the Republicans have been mewling about Obamacare since its inception, and it's been a really big campaigning issue for them. It's been a really big talking point. I'm confused as to how they don't have a plan ready to go when a Republican is sworn into office, because it seems to me that they had a bunch of different plans in any given time, and then they kind of threw it together, and then it didn't work that well in the House. They're kind of making a different one in the Senate. How are they dropping the ball on this, or are they dropping the ball on this?
This is the plaintive cry that undermines every single word that Reason's Peter Suderman writes about healthcare. Is like, guys, we had so long to think about this. Why didn't we have a plan? Because I do think that the procedural dysfunction is 100% traceable to the lack of substance underneath, the lack of guts to a Republican plan. Now, one reason that the Republicans never really came up with the plan is because the thing they should really be saying, the American public doesn't want to hear. The things that we've discussed in the past on this podcast about what kind of basic underlying principles we need to reform healthcare, which is stuff like getting the person who provides the care and the person who receives the care in a closer fiscal relationship, basically prices carry information. Also, the idea that there should be competition across states between plans, the idea that there should be policies offered that are catastrophic policies that have very, very stripped down coverage, that insurance should function as insurance rather than as a total, every single time you walk into a doctor's office, everything is paid for system. All of those ideas are things that people don't want to hear. So in that sense, I'm sympathetic to the Republicans. Maybe lots of people on the Hill know their principles, and they also know the American public is not going to put up with it. But that means they shouldn't have campaigned on the issue. That means they shouldn't have put all their eggs in that basket, because now what we're seeing is waffling that comes out of the fact that there is no principle undergirding their legislative agenda. And so it's 100% politics, and 100% politics is ugly.
There's a play that I really like called Democracy about the Willy Braun, I think it's Willy Braun's government in East Germany. And at one point, one of the characters says, our biggest mistake was we won because we knew how to be good opposition characters. We knew how to fight and take principled stands. We're not very good at leading. I sometimes see that when you see these transitions come from one to the other. Something Rand Paul floated last week, I believe, is the idea of potentially just repealing Obamacare before having a replacement in mind. Matt, is that a good idea? It seems to me that there would be a pretty high transition cost from that, and that there'd be a lot of people that would be in a very agitated state, not knowing what's coming next. But is that the right move?
The problem with that move, and it's not just a Rand Paul idea. Mike Lee has talked about that from the beginning. I think even Mitch McConnell, that was his original position, and then President Trump disagreed with that. So it's been kicked around for a while. While it has the strong benefit of repealing Obamacare, which I think is in many ways the problem. This is a historical problem with any large kind of social safety net legislation, is that once it exists, then it exists, and it is the status quo from which you can portray any change as boot stomping grandmothers, curb stomping grandmothers in the street. So that's the good part about it. The bad part about it is anything that involves we'll fix it later, including the transition questions and the overall legislative questions, because the fundamentals of it are the same, which is that it is a very tiny minority of senators and also in the House as well who are actually interested in repealing Obamacare, despite 7 years of campaigning to the contrary. By their works, we are knowing them, and they don't want to do it. They want to try to tinker around the edges with it and find something that's palatable that allows them to declare some kind of victory and then kind of keep the existing framework of what we have. So if this was going to happen, and it won't, it just won't. It's important to remember that from a practical politics standpoint. If it were to happen, then whatever it would be replaced by would end up looking, I think, a lot more like whatever Susan Collins' vision is than Rand Paul's vision. It is, I think, a better concept than what we have. But I think what we're gearing up towards here is at some point there will be someone who brings the bad news to President Trump that he doesn't get this victory right now. When you have essentially only one free market policy analyst, a free market leaning policy analyst that I've seen who has expressed any enthusiasm about this, which is Avik Roy, and everybody else is pretty steadfastly against that. When you have that, when you have popularity rankings that are 25 to 75 or 20 to 80 against, it seems inconceivable to me that this will ever get passed. And so once someone develops the courage, and maybe it'll be a default courage where John McCain stays recuperating in Sedona for the next 4 months, so it just never happens, then I think the next thing is going to get written not by Rand Paul and Justin Amash, but more by Susan Collins and Chuck Schumer. God help us. I wish that we could have had, and I said this and thought this at the time of Obamacare as well, passage. Everybody looks at the health insurance and the healthcare market in this country and sees the same original sin, which was tying healthcare to employment back as a post-World War II or World War II era artifact to get around a wage freeze. That's the problem, because it creates that third party issue that Nick has talked about in terms of education and other things. And until we get out of that, we can't get anywhere. And neither Obamacare nor what's been discussed here and passed the House and is still at a kind of 49 to 50 issue in the Senate actually does that. And until we do that, we can't get anything good going forward.
If I can, two quick follow-up points. One, Andrew, you mentioned Willy Brandt of West Germany, and of course his government collapsed because it turned out that one of his personal advisors was an East German spy. So there's always
it factors into the play, yeah.
Yeah, that maybe Donald Trump Jr. Or Baron Trump will be revealed to be an agent of the Kremlin, and that will change everything. But the other thing, what I was going to say is the, you know, this also shows for people who are really worried about Donald Trump becoming, you know, horrific and everything. Basically, what we're looking at, and there's, you know, there's every reason to believe that, you know, there's nothing that's going to come out of the Senate is not going to have a vote on this anytime soon, or if they do that, it'll pass. But, you know, Trump has been hemmed in. He has not been able to implement virtually any of the thing, all of, you know, the 900 things he said he was going to do within the first 15 minutes of taking office. And while I realize libertarians by default like gridlock, I'm not sure that I like gridlock as much as movement in the right direction, however unlikely that is. But, you know, what we're witnessing here is a system which is partly paralyzed because of polarization and because of an inability of people to actually lead and inspire through principles and through kind of rhetoric. But it's also, it's a sign that the, you know, there is not a lot of consensus in America. Obama passed the Affordable Health Care Act by the absolute slimmest of margin. And it's basically the only major piece of legislation, certainly in the 20th century, that was passed solely on a party line vote. And even then, barely. And I think Trump, you know, we're in the same situation where the Republicans have a slim majority, but it's not enough. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. It's a sign that we're in a holding pattern. And, you know, until somebody forges a new consensus, and I certainly hope, and I think all of us on this podcast and at Reason are trying to forge a consensus that is not the old conservative or the old liberal thing. But, you know, that's what we need to be working towards. And, you know, until then, you know, it's kind of a good thing that nobody can really force a minority position on everybody.
Well, we can hope that we'll move forward in a positive direction and at least add to that conversation and perhaps come up with something approaching a solvable plan for healthcare. In the meantime, we'll keep adding to it on our end. This has been the Reason Podcast. Thank you for listening to it. We'll be back again shortly. You can subscribe to us on iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. And Nick, Catherine, and Matt, thank you as always. I am smarter for having spoken to you.